And a very good morning to you. It's a few seconds now after 11 o'clock and time for another Red River Radio Spotlight. I'm Kermit Poling. Joining me in the studio, the music director of the Shreveport Symphony Orchestra, Michael Butterman, and the featured guest soloist on this concert that's going to be tomorrow evening, Jennifer Koh, a brilliant violinist who won the Tchaikovsky in the mid-90s and has performed with virtually... Well, if there's a major orchestra you haven't performed with, I'm not aware of it. We're glad to have her back in Shreveport. She has performed before with the Shreveport Symphony. But Michael, why don't you just talk a little bit, introduce us to what the program is going to be.
Well, the program is the works of Brahms and Sibelius. We have on the first half, of course, the violin concerto that Jennifer will be playing, which I'm sure she can tell you a little bit about in a moment, but also the well-known Finlandia, this... kind of patriotic tone poem, I guess, for lack of a better description, that became Sibelius' calling card and really eclipsed the fame of just about every other piece that he wrote, a little bit to his chagrin, I suppose. But it's one of those pieces that's both dramatic and also beautiful. The middle section has this tune that is familiar to members of lots of different Christian denominations. It's a hymn tune.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And it has become essentially a sort of a almost a national anthem for the... Is it actually the national anthem?
I think it is.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's probably the world's best national anthem.
There we go.
That's right. Right. It became a rallying cry, though, for the people of Finland.
It did. It was yeah. You know, written for part of a sort of a political... assembly, if you will, right around mm-hmm. the time that, you know, Russian domination of Finland was becoming extremely brutal, I guess, and hard. But it stirs national sentiment and patriotism very, 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 very well. And anyway, I think it's a great rousing way to open a concert, and especially usher in something like the Sibelius. And then we have the first symphony of Brahms after the intermission. You want me to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. We'll go into it in more detail, but you can actually, how you came up with the idea of tying all of these together would be I think,
you
an
know,
interesting.
That's a very good question. I wish I could say that there was some incredible motivic thread running through this that I want to illuminate in bringing these pieces together. But frankly, they're just works that I love. I think we haven't done the Sibelius here in quite some time.
Meaning the.
I'm sorry, the Sibelius
violin concerto.
Yes, exactly right.
And it's one of those... you know, because I always try to remember this, and after 28 years, I recall twice Stephanie Chase in the mid 90s and Eugene Fodor back even further. And that's it for such a warhorse of a concerto. And I mean that in a good way, but it doesn't get the same scheduling time as Tchaikovsky or Mendelssohn or one of those. And it's bizarre to me why it does.
It's certainly one of the, I don't know, big four or five violin concerti, I would have to say. And it has a symphonic kind of heft about it, the way it wouldn't be surprising considering the Sibelius' symphonic output and the way he thought.
Well, as long as you brought it up. Jennifer, you're the one who has the arduous task of performing this piece, which is a challenging work and a great work. Talk about your approach to it and your feelings about the concerto.
It's actually interesting that you guys use the word warhorse to describe the concerto, because I think for a long time I felt a little bit ambivalent about it because the approaches that I had heard before were very, you know, romantic warhorse kind of musical mm-hmm. approach, and it wasn't something I understood in a way. And it's just been recently that I finally felt like I came to an understanding of the piece, which is that it's really quite revolutionary. The dissonances, the harmonies, the rhythm, the fact that most of the time I'm in a complete, you know, the orchestra and the soloists are in totally different rhythmic values. The fact that when you open the concerto, you know, you have F natural and A, and then the violin just comes searingly in the middle of the pitch.
Right.
So essentially out of key initially. And then when all of the elements come together, it's actually incredible when we do go into the same harmony. And in fact, there's a place where we go into unison, where I go into unison with the orchestra, and it's an incredibly powerful moment, I think. And in fact, because there are all of these kind of dissonances before, and those are things that I really feel like... I wanted to bring out in the concerto, to bring out its cragginess, I guess, in a way, and not not just its romantic.
Right. Well, the cragginess actually is a good word. It makes a lot of sense, especially thinking of the, I know, the isolation of the cold north and all of that, which to me is the opening of the concerto that you're referring to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what
yeah.
it feels like to me.
Yeah.
I used to, but you're right. It is has a lot of. Not dissonance in a bad way, but a lot of these
tension. I think
that's
tension.
Yeah, exactly. And now, as a kid, I used to listen to that recording of Heifetz, the original mm-hmm. recording that made the piece popular with Beckham and the London Phil. Probably every night. Probably drove my parents crazy because I would just play it and play it and play it and play it and play it. But it had a certain attractiveness that those elements obviously mm-hmm. come together. So even though we're using words like dissonance and all of that, it's an incredibly beautiful and touching piece.
And dramatic piece, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the way I kind of approached it was through a contemporary Finnish composer, Kaija Saariaho. And it's interesting that generation of composer, Asa-Pekka, Salonen, Kaija Saariaho, and Magnus Lindberg, they first started very much because Sibelius was such a huge weight in compositional weight in Finland. And, mm-hmm. you know, like with Finlandia, what Michael was saying, that it's the national anthem. So there was a great deal, everybody knew Sibelius. And from speaking to each of them, they've all told me it was almost too much weight to deal with when they were younger. So I think in a way they all kind of moved away from it. But somehow through doing Kaija's concerto, that's how I found my path to the Sibelius. Which I don't know if she would be so thrilled about, but it's actually true.
Well, it makes a great contrast to the Brahms first, I think, and yet, as you were referring to other performances you've heard of the Sibelius being so romantic, it has that romantic part to it, which of course is right in home territory for Brahms.
It is, and you know, as I was listening to Jennifer describe this, I was thinking maybe there is more of a thread than I realized, because you know, Sibelius's symphonies in particular, he gives you these little ideas at the beginning, and you're not quite sure what to make of them, and then gradually over time they sort of accrete, you know, they sort of stick to one another, and then something bigger. The bigger picture kind of emerges, and I think especially in the first movement, to me that's sort of what happens in the concerto, and that's in a way the reverse process of what Brahms does. I mean, Brahms, like Beethoven, was a great tinkerer with motives and so on. He has something a little bit bigger in mind, and then he sort of takes things apart and examines them, and then eventually puts them back together for you. So in a way, they're both concerned with very very small scale details of construction, but then they have their way of assembling them for you at the end. But you know, this symphony of Brahms, I think I said in our press blurb that it's the greatest first symphony, or symphony number one in his. You could say that Mahler's is right up there, certainly, and the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, although he didn't give it a number. But you know, it's got to be among them, and this is in no small part because he was 43, I believe it was, when this yeah. piece was finally published. And by genius composer standards, that's awfully late to be making your first foray into what was probably still the most important serious compositional genre of the time. But in no small part, again, was because of the fact that there was all of this anticipation that was heaped upon Brahms since the time he was in his early 20s, that here now was the person who would carry the tradition of Beethoven forward, and imagine the kind of pressure that puts on a young composer. And so he made lots of attempts. He wrote things that eventually turned into parts of the Requiem and two orchestral serenades, the first piano concerto, all of these different works that sort of started off as maybe symphonic, and then finally he was happy enough with this work that turned into the first symphony. But it has this C minor to C major kind of journey, the same thing that happens in the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven. Mm. It has, in some places, this very strong yatatata, ratatata, the short, 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 long, which again you have in the Fifth Symphony. He uses trombones and only in the finale, just like mm-hmm. Beethoven does in the Fifth Symphony. And of course, in the last movement, we have a slow introduction, but then this very, very beautiful, tuneful melody played for us by the strings that has, in some ways, this character of a little bit like the Ode to Joy theme of Beethoven Ninth Symphony. And of course, famous reaction of Brahms when someone pointed that out was, well, any idiot, I will say, on radio can see that, as if to say, yes, and your point is what? Yes, if that's the only thing you're getting from this, then you're missing right. everything that I've done. Yeah. But to me, it's a piece that's just, in the four symphonies of Brahms, I don't know, it doesn't get any better as a musician than those works, I don't think.
I definitely agree with you. And, you know, when I think of Brahms, you know, we think of that connection to Beethoven and all of that. But if he had just lived a little longer, you know, he would have been a part of the 20th century. We have recordings of him. They're not very good, but, you know, Edison had his team go over and record him. And they're very hard to hear because they've been so degraded through the years. But you hear Brahms playing the piano and you think, wow, we have recordings of this man who in our minds tends to be like right. way back there.
Right.
But wasn't so far back.
No, in 1897 he died, and just almost made it into the 20th century.
Almost made it there. So I often wonder what would have happened if Brahms and Sibelius actually knew each other, because there would have been that potential for that.
I suppose. Yes, indeed.
So this concert is tomorrow evening. It's at 7:30 p.m. and it's at the Riverview Theater in downtown Shreveport. And this great mix of music. Jennifer, I thought it would be a nice opportunity since, also for us, to get to hear a little bit of your playing here and hopefully inspire some people to come to the concert, but also to talk a little bit about the projects that you're working on. And we do have a CD here that you brought with you that relates to a project, Bach and Beyond. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that is and what the CD is?
Oh, yes. Bach and Beyond was... my own way of kind of coming to an understanding of how it is that Bach's music, which was written over 300 years ago, is such, still communicates in such a visceral way. You know, 300 years later, totally different society, totally different culture. There's something so human and yet kind of elevated about his music. So Bach and Beyond is about exploring his influence on kind of solo violin writing. Over the years, historically, and so not only is it in a kind of exploration on his own music, which is kind of the solo music for violin that he wrote, is still kind of considered the pinnacle of solo violin writing, mm-hmm. and how that's kind of, I wanted to explore how that's kind of influenced composers over the years. So Bach and Beyond Part One, which is out on CD now, has the E major partita and the Isai second sonata, which has little bits of the E major partita in it. But really, the main thematic material running throughout it is the Dies Irae. So it's kind of moving from the E major partita, it's kind of very light, and then it moves into darkness with the Isai. And then I chose pieces that were kind of, Nocturne is written by Caius Arjaho as kind of in memoriam of Lutosławski, a great Polish composer. Mm-hmm. And then moving into the format of the Chaconne, there's the Mazzoli piece, which is based on the first chord of the Chaconne. It's a D minor chord. And the Chaconne itself is really this kind of incredible piece that reaches kind of transcendent places, and it's really, for me personally, it's kind of this human struggle to reach transcendence in the most incredible sure. musical way possible.
Sure. As much as I'd love to play some of the Chaconne, time being a constraint, I queued up something a little bit shorter, actually, the last movement from the Isai.
Okay.
Why don't you just say a little something about that movement before we hear it?
Les Furies.
Yeah.
It's a bit, I would call it a bit, it's like its title. It's quite furious.
Well, for some reason, it struck me as being the closest thing that we had on hand to the Sibelius, which
in
which
a way,
be performing
yes,
tomorrow.
I think so. Yes.
All right. So here's Music of Isai. This is Jennifer Koh performing from her new CD, Bach and Beyond. Thank you. Music of Isai. We hear the last movement, the Furies, from his unaccompanied violin sonata. Number two, the violinist was Jennifer Koh, who is the soloist tomorrow evening with the Shreveport Symphony Orchestra performing the violin concerto of Jean Sibelius, along with the symphony, and Michael Butterman conducting listening to that recording. This is off of a brand new CD that just came out, right? This Bach.
I think it came out a year ago.
Oh, okay. So, but you're working on another one.
Yes.
So Bach and Beyond, and thank you for bringing the recording and a sampling of the wonderful playing that you'll get to hear tomorrow night, along with a lot of great romantic orchestral music. Michael, anything you want to add about the performance tomorrow?
Well, I just think it's a great way to open a season, and the Shreveport Symphony and the musicians, I think, are sounding great, and we're happy to be back after the summer performing again and looking forward to seeing everybody.
All right. Tomorrow evening's performance, 7:30, Riverview Theater, downtown Shreveport. You can get more information and buy tickets at ShreveportSymphony.com. You can also call the tune line, 318-227-TUNE, that is 8863. And I'm Kermit Poling. We've been talking with Michael Butterman and Jennifer Koh. Thanks, guys, for being here. And if you are with an organization and you have an event coming up and you'd like to be featured on a future spotlight, be sure to give us a call, 8800-552-8502. And as long as you have that in mind, we're going to give away some tickets for tomorrow evening's performance. So if you are among the first three callers to call now at 800-552-8502, a pair of tickets to tomorrow evening's performance of the Shreveport Symphony can be yours.